the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got Martin Page.
Hi, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hi, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hey, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
And today with us, all the way from Virginia, we've got Vanessa Levitt.
Woo!
Sitting
on the
Thank you.
Vanessa, welcome.
Thanks.
Just to let everybody know, Vanessa is the web mistress for...
Web mistress. Wow, it sounds so...
For the for the MySpace page for the Audio Nowcast, but also handles a lot of the stuff for Martin.
She certainly does.
She's a damn good mistress for our website. Damn good mistress. Sorry about that, Brian. Her husband's here as well.
Don't let that get around.
So Vanessa, she does a great job. She handles both of the emails that come in once a month to the Audio Nowcast, and I know she does a lot of stuff for Martin and with the not only MySpace but also YouTube, and just a great member of the team. Just
certainly is.
We could not do without her.
Thank you.
So welcome, Vanessa, and
thanks,
feel free
Mike.
To comment on anything that we talk about.
Feel free to make intelligence of this.
No.
Intelligence is not an option.
It's a word that's not used around here, is it, Mike?
Vanessa, are there any challenges that you have with working with our stuff, being...
We don't have that long to talk, do we? No, it's great. It's not that bad.
One question that I want to ask is... because somebody actually asked me when I was telling them about, that we have somebody who helps us with the MySpace page, and because they were thinking about setting up the whole thing. And they want to know why you do it. And so I said, well, I don't know. I'll ask her.
So, good question.
That is a good question. It's just fun. It's good. It's good to be part of the team. You guys are awesome. So.
That's it.
Wow,
it's not the money, so.
Well, we know that.
Yeah.
So. We know that.
It's the water. It's the free water. I really appreciate the water. Yeah.
I think it's great that you got involved. And actually, yeah. Vanessa, it's really funny. And you've already been on a podcast. She was on like our sixth podcast that we did. Mm-hmm. But, unbeknownst to her, way back when we were touring with Martin, she was actually at a show that we did in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
That's a pretty amazing story, really, because it was the first gig that we did on the beginning of the tour. And it was a particularly good gig. And
it was.
And only after all those years was I made aware that Vanessa was there at that gig. And so that was pretty magical that all took place.
And that was crazy. And it started on an email. Vanessa sent me an email and said a few kind things about our podcast, and I remember it because it was one of the few emails that were kind about our podcast.
Oh, one of the few emails. Here. Yeah.
And
just so it's framed behind your head on the wall.
No, and then she said it, and I'd love to help you guys any way that we can, and that was like, woohoo!
Yeah.
She wants to help us. All I heard was free labor, so
sweet.
So
sweet.
But it just goes to show you, though, if you're out there and you want to get involved with somebody, drop them an email, because you never know where it can lead.
You may find yourself a mistress.
You never know.
So, Vanessa, thank you for being here.
Yeah,
today.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you in 3D.
Yeah, it's cool. Thanks.
I also want to talk a little bit about a couple things before we go. We're going to be talking about songwriting today. Specifically, we're going to talk about collaboration in the second part, because we actually meant to get to that on the last podcast, but we spent way too much time on Martin.
Lovely. Damn good show. One of the best you've ever done.
Best. Got a lot of email about that one.
Tremendous response. I would do more of those if I was you.
I don't know. Bobby doesn't look too thrilled or excited. So today we're going to talk about songwriting and talk about collaborating. So that'll be kind of cool. One thing I do want to talk about in the tech realm is I don't know if you guys are familiar with the product OpenStomp. Have you heard about that?
Nope.
Yeah. And I think it's
so this is going to be a great conversation, isn't it?
No,
none of us have heard of it.
No, but it's one of those things that.
Is it to do with drums?
No.
Rhythm?
No. What it is it's a...
guitar stomp pedals?
It's an open source.
Oh, I guess that makes me the expert on it.
Yes, you are.
Let me tell you what I think of it, Mike.
No, but really, I think this is a really exciting thing. It's an open source guitar stomp pedal.
Who created it?
You know what? I found out about this through a great site called Create Digital Music. It's one of the websites that I like to read. And if you go to the posting, and I'll let you read all about it, of dated, I'll tell you right now. The August 26th posts, they gave a preview of OpenStomp. It's, you know, open source, sound effects. But what really caught my eye on this is, you know, here you have hardware. You know, they've always had development kits for software, and you could create your own software through things like, Reactor and Max and those other languages. But now, you know, hardware where you can start programming your own effects. I mean, that's pretty powerful. I think that's going to be a pretty cool tool. I mean, what do you think, just when I mentioned that right off the bat, you know, having that kind of control, Rob, what do you think about that? Just
well, there have been other hardware things like that. I mean, I'm not familiar with it, but a bunch of Eventides boxes have been hardware that let you design your own effects. And Andrew and I have both suffered through the process of creating effects. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing where it's really cool because you can do anything you can think of. I think, practically speaking, unless they make the design really, really simple, it's not something you would do while you're in the middle of trying to get some work done.
Well, the cool thing about this, though, is rather than coming from a company, it's open source. So basically, you're not just, you know, everybody can write stuff for it, and it's going to be licensed for everybody else to use. So, you know, you can... You know, there could be a library of hundreds of effects.
And I think is the deal that there is a physical pedal that has a stock DSP chip and then a couple of knobs.
Exactly. Four knobs, in and out, stock DSP, and then you can program it. And it's the box is going to cost like $349.
It'll probably be a cool way to get a bunch of new effects for free because if it's open source, people will be sharing the stuff on the web. What I'm saying is if the idea is that it's open source and people are encouraged to create their own, that's less practical. But if you find people, you know, if you look at open source programming languages, it's the same thing. You can find people who, out of the goodness of their hearts, somehow find the time to create something really cool and give it away for free. That could be cool. Although $349, what does it come with for that? Does it come with a bunch of stuff already?
You know what? I don't know. It'll probably come with some effects. You'll probably be able to download it. So far, they've already had things like distortion and chorus and delay. And you know, people are going to get a hold of that and do all kinds of weird little wobbly noises and gates and things of that nature. I just think it's pretty cool. I think it's a trend we're going to see more and more of, you know, when you start seeing these little open source things, you know, when they get an open source synth out there and, you know, drum modules and samplers and things like that.
Open source is definitely cool. But it's about how many talented people adopt it and actually develop it.
Yeah, but even if you're like one guy and you do one patch that is a gem, you know, it really caught my eye. It was really a great buzz because, you know, as a sound designer and someone who does a lot of editing and stuff, it'd be great to have in my little arsenal so that I could, like, when I need some bizarre effect that you don't even know, you just download something. Hey, what does this sound like?
But you don't play guitar.
No, but you can use pedals for more than just guitar.
There you go.
I don't know. What
nice
do you think?
Setup.
That was good.
Did I read that properly?
You read that great. What do you think, Bobby? So, Andrew, would you ever use something like that?
I don't know. I mean, I'd have to see what sort of patches, because the thing is, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun for the people who kind of want to program to get into it, and then they won't be creating anything that's that crazy or new or...
Yeah, it's all up to who actually ends up designing for it.
Yeah.
Because like I say, in the Eventide days, if you go back 10 years ago, these were popular boxes and anybody could design their own patches for them. They gave you the software to do it for free, but it wasn't easy and most people didn't want to take the time to do it. And so even though it was, you know, it's sort of open source the same way this stuff is open source, this is cheaper, right? Like $350, but it's still not free. Mm-hmm. So you have to have people who've bought the box who want to then develop for the box. It's just going to be a wait and see to see if enough cool effects are developed.
Yeah, well, they have a screenshot of the programming environment, and it's very, you know, object-oriented, you know, a lot of boxes, and you can audio in, and then you have an effect and things like that. So I don't think it's going to be, you know, that difficult to program for, and I just think it's a great trend. You know, I'd love to see more open source kind of programmable boxes and synths and things like that. Is there a key, a good keyboard out there, like hardware keyboard? I think that would be a really cool thing. I don't know if there is or not.
A good
open source keyboard, like a hardware module that would be really interesting if there was ever something like that.
I don't know.
Because, I mean, I know you can do it software and you can always have a mini keyboard, but it'd be great to have actual, you know, oscillators in a box that you can have a digital environment that can control all that.
You know, most of the times these things, there's so much cost to develop it that most people aren't going to develop it to give it away. Because it's not even that big of a market, you know, the musical instrument market.
That's true, too.
Anyhow. It's a wait and see. If some people come up with cool algorithms.
Yeah, that would be the key.
Well, I know you're going to get one, though.
Yeah, we'll just borrow yours.
Yeah.
We'll see. But, Mark, would you ever use anything like that? Would you ever, like, use a...
You know, to be honest with you, it gets to the point where I've got so much stuff and so many ways to change the sounds already. You know, even on, you know, for instance, if I'm on Pro Tools and you find a pad you like on a keyboard, you can put up the wave stomp pedals and play with that keyboard and make, you know, put six different stomp pedals on it. And then I'll put it through an effects unit. And then I'll just record the effects unit of those six different sounds, and and then you've got it. And, you know, it's an original. So, and when you come down to it, you're looking at chorus, flanger, phaser, distortion. And, you know, I've sort of come to that conclusion now that if I can't do something original with the stuff I've got, then there's a problem.
Yeah, definitely. It's got to be
with creativity.
Definitely.
You know,
I think that... you know, a lot of these companies, they're obviously relying on the fact that there are people just starting out who have no gear. But the truth is, anybody who's bought any gear in the last 3, 4, 5 years, everything does everything.
Yeah, that's true.
You know? How many hundreds of flangers do you need?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But if you're starting from nowhere, you need something. I mean, you got to start something.
But you know what? I think something like this, what would really turn me on about it would be the sounds, the possibilities of the weird stuff, you know, like the bizarre filters and the weird gating and, you know, just all.
And hopefully they realize that that's what'll make it unique and they'll ship it with, you know, a lot of that stuff available.
Cause I remember like, when I first got a hold of a Reactor, I don't know if you've used it much.
Yeah, Reactor's good.
The one thing a couple years ago that I programmed was it my own little, swoosh module, and all it did was just generate swooshes because I'm working in post-production. Everything
swoosh.
Everything has a little
swooshes.
Swooshes?
I've seen that, the Rodriguez swoosh.
That's a whole different thing.
Oh, I'm thinking of something totally different.
It's totally different. Yeah.
So keep quiet.
But it was great. You know, it was good just to be able to customize something like that. So I'm sure it'll find a market somewhere. You know, to do open source stuff.
Things like Reactor are amazingly cool. Reactor is a good example of one of the first things where you could actually design your own sounds. But I also found, If we're working on a project where we had really loose deadlines or no budget, which meant we could take as long as we wanted because no one was paying for it anyway, then you can take the time to dream and to design your own sounds. And there have been a lot of gadgets over the years like Reactor or like the Eventide stuff or like Akima or some of these things.
Max or...
Yeah, all these things are cool to design stuff. But if you're actually trying to get work done on a deadline, you either have to have a huge library to pull from so you can get to it instantly, or you're not going to sit there and...
Yeah, I mean, it can take you 4 hours just to get it to pass signal.
Exactly.
No, that's... You know what? You guys bring up a great point, because sometimes...
We always do.
That's why we're here, Mike.
That's right.
Wow.
What do you think, Bobby?
Wow. But you brought up a good point, though, and the fact that sometimes the hardware can keep you from creating when you actually need to get work and... When you need to get something done, sometimes the hardware can come in between you and your idea, you know.
Quite a bit, then
sometimes people, and I've totally been guilty of this, just hide behind, you know, whatever program because through lack of ideas, you're searching for something. So you just start digging in and you tweaking presets or anything. And just, you know, get to the point where you like justify being in your studio. because you want to work on music, but yet you don't feel so guilty because you're like
brings up an interesting point though. When you recently on TV they had a documentary on Hendrix. You know, when he was playing at I think it was the first gig he did in America, the big festival. What was it, Andrew, that he really exploded on when he burnt his guitar on stage?
It was a Monterey.
And I'm telling you, you know, the sounds he got out of that guitar.
Yeah.
The sounds he got out of one strap with just a Marshall, how he was dealing with feedback and how near he was walking to the amplifier. Yeah, was
and a couple of pedals.
Exactly.
And that's it.
Unbelievable. I mean, I just sat back and thought, those sounds are phenomenal. And you can't find those sounds. And this is, you know, not much going on except for a person's using what he had.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, sometimes when you don't have a lot, you tend to experiment a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I found since I got the Dopefer modular synth, which I think we talked about many podcasts ago. And so you really say, okay, well, I want a phaser and I want to control it like this. And you get really, really specific because otherwise it doesn't do anything.
Right.
It's all I use now. Mm-hmm. I don't use the Eventide boxes because there you sort of know what you want and you end up like, mm-hmm. Oh, is that preset it? Is that a preset a good starting point? And you'll go through 50 presets, an hour and a half has gone by, and you've forgotten kind of what you had in your head. Instead of just building it from the ground up really quickly and doing it and being done, like with what you're saying with the stomp pedals. So it may be that this pedal is the perfect thing like that. It forces you to really simplify, know what you want, program something up real quick, and do it, and it'll be great. Or it could be that you'll spend 5 hours on the internet looking for an open source patch that's like kind of close to what you think you want.
Yeah.
That's true. Cause boy, I have a hard time picking through the couple hundred snares that I have in my sample library.
Yeah.
I can't imagine when there's like thousands of like gates.
Yeah. When I'm mixing something and you feel like, oh, I really need a pad here. And I've got, I don't know, you know, 50 million choices for what sort of sound it could be. It is either Mellotron samples or my harmonium 95% of the time. Mm-hmm. Because they always work, and they're to hand, and I don't have to think about them. And done.
I find myself coming back to a Prophet 5 all the time. Oh, yeah. You know, and you go like, this is going to work.
Yep.
The guitars can sit on this.
I mean,
properly.
There's nothing wrong with having a huge library and going through it and knowing it. And like we've talked about, you have to know it so you sort of know where to go. But it's...
there are some things that work well.
You just go down the rabbit hole for an afternoon and get nothing done.
And another point of what you said about songwriting, sometimes the song... you know, dictates what you need to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you lean on that and you say, well, this snare doesn't work properly, and I think we've talked about this before, but the song is telling you what kind of snare you need, you know. That helps in some way.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think if you're going to get involved with something open source, just, you know, just have some discipline. Basically, that's what the whole key is. Just you got to be disciplined so you don't get lost in technology. And then there's always those people who are going to be lost in technology anyhow because they get into music for the technology, not necessarily for the music. So,
And hopefully they'll be uploading all the cool patches so you don't have to spend the time doing
it.
Well, you know what? I've been doing a lot more programming lately, and I'm using a lot of open source languages, and it amazes me how much stuff people create and upload just for the sake of sharing it. I can't personally imagine having enough free time to create a lot of these things that I'm finding up there. And I'm very grateful. They're excellent, and you can build
you
on them.
You mean like Linux, for instance?
Yeah, exactly. Like an entire operating system. It's incredible.
Yeah, I have that.
No, how does that work?
It's just really amazing.
When do you
really
find
amazing.
That time?
they're just living a different kind of life than I think any of us are. But that part of open source is exciting. The fact that people are willing to share ideas just for the glory of being able to say, I came up with a cool idea.
I saw a great fan movie on YouTube on Gremlins 2. It's a guy who took Gremlins 2 and did a remix, basically, and inserted Gremlins into all these different movies, like Batman and Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then on the page, there's also a YouTube on the making of. And he actually made... Gremlin, the little puppets and things like that, and painted them and, you know, puppeteered and shot all this footage and then rotoscoped it in. And he did all this stuff just for his fan movie. And it's just like, who has that kind of time to do all that?
What trust fund is he living off of that he can do that?
Well, or whose basement is he living in?
Yeah. But it was just, it's along the same lines. It's amazing.
Sorry, I don't mean to be mean. It's probably fantastic.
And one of the, speaking of little, you know, pet projects like that, one of the best things I've ever heard was actually Rob, you showed it to me where a friend of yours used an Emacs sampler and created the...
going way back.
Yeah. Created Rush Limbaugh singing. That was just amazing. He recorded...
He basically recorded every Rush Limbaugh... Actually, he did this with a few. He did it with the first President Bush. He did it with Clinton. He would record every Rush Limbaugh show for months, and then he would weed through it. He had written the lyrics he wanted to have Rush sing for the song, and he would wait till he found every syllable already on the right pitch at the right speed.
Oh.
And then he used the sampler, the Emacs at the time, to cut it together syllable by syllable. And you couldn't do great pitch shifting or time compression back then. So he had to wait until he found every syllable at the right pitch and the right speed.
And it sounded phenomenal, though. And it's not easy getting him to say, "I'm a Nazi."
Yeah, he actually had Rush Limbaugh singing, "I'm a Nazi." It was absolutely hilarious.
It was hilarious. And I was blown away. Because I was a dialogue editor at the time, and I was like, oh my gosh, the work that he did.
Well, cause he also played it. You know, the Emacs was just a sampling keyboard, so he would have to build the phrases and perform them. He would play each syllable. It was exhausting. Yeah. But
history now. We're all talking about it.
Yeah. And I will give him a shout out. He goes by the name The Invisible Man. So wherever you are, Invisible Man, we're talking about
you. We appreciate it.
Yeah. It's impressive.
We can't
stuff.
See you, but
no.
We know you're there.
We know you're there.
I wonder why he's invisible. Do you think it's for fear of being found or
by Rush?
Yeah.
Couldn't tell you.
Yeah, there's a link we'll never be able to post.
Yeah, well, I'm sure some Emacs fan site, you know, still talks about him.
That's a good idea. I'll have to see if it's up there somewhere. It's pretty funny. Hey, I want to move on before we get talking about songwriting. Richard Marx.
Is he here? What?
When I say Richard Marx, what comes to your mind? Anybody?
A man.
Singer, songwriter?
The human being. The youngest of the Marx brothers, right? He's the one who took Zeppo's
singer.
Place.
Okay.
Yeah, he was the one with the big hair, but he didn't have the little squeeze horn.
Okay.
He played harp.
I don't contemporary music.
How about...
Many hits.
Right Here Waiting. What comes to your mind?
A song.
Perhaps with something to do with Richard Marx.
Bobby? Well, I don't know.
The reason why I say that is the other day I was in the car with a couple of friends and a Richard Marx song came on and it was Right Here Waiting. And as soon as it came on the radio,
you cried?
No, it was like everybody's like, "Oh, Richard Marx," and they're like, "Oh, you know, it's so cheesy," and you know, just all this stuff. And I'm like, and I was really surprised at the whole, you know, that's so cheesy, you know, and all that, you know, instant machismo that happened and the whole thing. And I said, no, we're going to listen to this song, you know. So we listened to the whole song. And as I'm sitting there listening to the song and crying, actually.
Yeah.
Putting a little tear
that's
in my
emotional.
Eye. No. Two things came to my mind. I want to talk about it before we start talking about songwriting. Number one, the tremendous amount of hostility that my friends had towards Richard Marx and the song. And the second thing was, you know what? It's not a bad song, you know, as far as the song goes, the way the arrangement and the recording. I just want to know, how does a song get to be like that? Where does it turn? At one time it was a hit and now people just like, you know, disdain
them. When that song was a hit, there were plenty of people who thought it was cheesy.
I understand that too, but it's just like, how does that happen?
I think it's a lot to do with the time and the fashion sense at that time and whether they can relate to the artist of that period. It's the same for Starship, with my song We Built the City. You know, a lot of people go, that's, you know, a terrible song for them to record, and it's because they would say that they'd sold out, you know.
Right, so because they were saying it as being so different than what they'd done before.
Yeah, I think Michael Bolton suffers for the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an era when, you know, and also, you know, Phil Collins suffered for it because of a lot of the mid-songs and the AC success. And, of course, it's an era. And sometimes an artist will suffer because they're seen in that light. And also if they get really exposed.
I think part of it is too, because Michael Bolton and Richard Marx in different ways both suffer from this. They both always came off, at least to me, like they were trying way too hard to be like Mr. Super Emotional Guy. I mean, especially in Michael Bolton's case. I mean, I guess there are some women who like having love songs barked at them the way he often would. But, I mean, he would scream, I love you. And that just gets old after a while. And I think maybe when it's new, people don't – not as many people recognize it for how cheesy it's going to seem down the road. But it's like a fashion that comes and goes. You know, Richard Marx was one of the first guys to do this sort of cutesy, emotional – oh, baby, I just want you to love me kind of persona.
Yeah, but there's been a lot, you know, in the 70s you had some really cheesy love songs and, you know, and that's.
Yeah, and a lot of them were thought of as cheesy and a lot weren't, but you asked why did you get this reaction from people about Richard Marx? I think that was a pretty widespread reaction to him. He definitely has written some amazing songs, but I think the best songs he's written are ones that he didn't sing.
But sometimes that judgment, it's not even to do with the song. It's to do with the era, the time, the way it was seen, the video.
What about the
image of the artist at that time.
How it was perceived. Nothing. And if you go back and, like you were saying, Mike, and you look at the song, it's a damn good song. You know, it's a pretty good song. But in front of that, it's the fashion sense, the time, the era, the video, the way it came across.
And you know what? A lot of people, when they're dressed super trendy in a video or they're trying so hard to be on the cutting edge, they're moving away from all the stuff that's considered classic, and you end up looking at it 10, 20 years later, and the styles have moved on, and they really stand out as, like, extra cheesy.
And a little extra cheese.
Sugar, sugar, da-da-da-da-da-da. I like that one.
That was a good one.
The Archies.
All right, really quick, before we hit the break, guilty pleasure, Vanessa. Give me a guilty pleasure song, group, artist.
I actually kind of like Richard Marx. Yeah. I'll go with that.
Richard Marx.
I think you do too, Mike. I otherwise, you wouldn't bring it up. I mean,
Bobby's
vomiting in the corner. Right?
It's going to be hard to recover from this one.
Come on. All right, let's.
Guilty pleasure. Now, what do you mean by guilty pleasure?
A group or a song that you think is pretty good, but you wouldn't necessarily, you know, tell the world about it, although you
sugar,
are now.
Sugar, sugar.
Everything I like is super cool.
Yeah.
Come on, Andrew. There has to be a Barry Manilow buried back there somewhere.
No, I don't know. I don't know what it would be.
You can't get him to say that. He'll never get any more work.
Well, that's true, too.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind, but I can't. I can't really think of one right
Rob?
Now.
Rob?
I definitely have some. You know what? I think I have some guilty pleasures that a lot of people would not immediately say was something they like, but a lot of people actually like it. Like, you had asked us one time before to prepare a list of songs that were guilty pleasures, and the one that kept coming back to me was Barry White's song, You're My First, Last, My Everything. You know, it's just like corny disco, but it's about the happiest song ever written, and I just completely love it. And I think most people trying to be cool might say they don't like it, but if that song actually comes on in the room, I think everybody loses their mind. And there are a lot of songs like that, but that's one that
Pagey?
Came to me.
You know, I was a big pop fan when I was a kid, so, you know. If I go back and look at my record collection, you know, I did buy the Archies, you know, because I thought it was a bloody good
song. The Archies
were
great.
You know, that sugar, I thought that's a good song.
If that's a guilty pleasure, I'm there with you.
All right, mate. Yeah, so that's my guilty pleasure, the Archies. What about you, Bob?
I don't care.
It doesn't like anyone, does it?
I like, mine is from the 80s, Men Without Hats. Huge Men Without Hats.
That's a good record.
Yeah, good.
That was they could do what they were playing.
Yeah, you don't have to be so guilty about that.
You would think, but when I'm playing in my bay and people are walking in, what are you listening to?
You know, even bands like Duran Duran suffered for a long time that way.
Yeah.
You know?
So then they go through it and they come out again.
Yeah, they actually came around. It was
You know what? Journey's a great example.
Yes.
You know? Journey swings to totally cheesy.
It's California rock. Yeah. But then you look at the albums and you got some exceptional music there, you know, so.
Well, before we wrap this up, let me ask you, as a songwriter, Martin, if you're writing a song, should you even be worried about something like this? Like your song, you know, getting dated or turning into one of those,
I think it's a real thing when you're writing with artists or at a certain time. You know, when I was writing with Go West and we had two songs together that were hits, I was very aware that we were writing for a certain market. But luckily, because we were thinking that we loved great soul music like Al Green or Prince's best stuff, we sort of try to construct a song, and Go West very much like that. Let's do a song that, you know, like the Horn Oates did for a while. You know, right. You just felt they were really good soul songs. But as I just brought up, you know, Starship suffered with We Built This City because of people were related to their previous history and that they had a number one song. They paid for it, you know. But particularly now, well, really, I've always felt very strongly that you shouldn't really write too much to fashion, because I think you're going to suffer. I think you need to write a bloody good song that, you know, you can play a Motown song, you know, Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and that can be recorded and recorded and recorded and recorded, and it still has a quality. So to me, it was always, let's try and write a song that we can, that's going to just last. You know, I was very aware, though, I will say, very aware of being terrified that if you're too fashionable or too on the nose of something that's happening now and may go, you're going to suffer.
You know, I'm sorry, Bobby, let me just say this one thing, then you can speak. No. I just wanted to say, we've talked about it on a previous podcast, that you should never set out to write a hit song. Like, if you sit down and say, okay, our main purpose right here is to write a hit, it just never happens.
No.
Right.
A song becomes a hit because somehow you connect with the audience and they feel that you've connected with what you've written. But if you sit down and say, well, you know, that so-and-so song was a hit, so let's write something like that. Unless, you know, the song like the hit is never the hit.
Unless you're writing for Hannah Montana and it's going to buy you a house.
Well, hey,
on that note, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to listen to some comments from Scott, because he's been pretty quiet for this half. So
yeah, Scott, we'll trade Bobby for Scott.
There you go.
Okay.
All right. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And we actually picked up a panel member, Scott. Welcome, right. Scott.
Hello, thank you.
I know you were mixing in close by here.
I was just on the block.
Yeah. Somebody's
working. What were you working on, really quick?
I was working on the director who did Chronicles of Riddick.
Oh, okay.
He's doing a little movie called Perfect Getaway, so we were doing a little temp dub for it. And there you go.
Oh, great. And what stage were you on? I'm just curious, just for my own curiosity.
It's Taddeo Burbank, stage 2.
Oh, okay. So it was really close.
Yeah.
See, we timed that perfect. So as we were ending the first half, Scott shows up.
And, well, so the closer he works, the later he is.
Yeah, it's true, huh?
How does that work?
Yeah, because if you're on the west side, you're here in like 15 minutes.
It was great. We did like I don't even think the banker's hours. We started at 10:30, and then we finished at 8:30. Rather than the 9 to 7, so I don't know. Go figure.
Wow. Those are my kind of hours, because I prefer to sleep in. So.
I know, me too.
All right. Well, hey, before the break, we were talking a little bit about, we pretty much hashed out all that whole cheesy song thing. So we'll move forward. I want to talk a little bit about songwriting and collaboration. And specifically, I have an incident I want to tell you guys about, and kind of gave me the idea for doing this and on the podcast. A couple podcasts ago, I mentioned that I was looking for a female singer because I'm trying to do this little project band, just something fun, just because I figured I have the equipment and I have some time. Every now and then I get a little bit of time, but you know, when you do music, you have to do music. And so I just wanted to create and be creative. To make a long story short, I put out an ad in Craigslist and looking for a female vocalist, and didn't work out against all the advice that you guys gave me.
Got plenty of dates though.
So I had a friend and she was a singer, and we started doing a little bit of writing, and I wanted to collaborate. So I was really looking for, you know, something, an environment where we could get together and do some writing and work on some music. And it just turned out horribly. It was just wrong. It was a clash of not only styles, but it was just, you know, where she wanted to go and the melodies and where, you know, I could kind of hear it. Just, it wasn't the same. And I was trying to be open and have an open mind, but it just didn't work out. And I'm thinking,
what was her name and where does she live and what's her name? poor girl.
She didn't listen, does she?
You know what? There was a little bit of a diva complex. I will say that. And
on what side, you or her?
Oh, good one. Good one, Martin. Yeah, that
one. Yeah, Bob.
Probably. Shut up.
But there was definitely a diva complex, and I just, obviously, like when I would say something and do a little constructive criticism, it'd get way too emotional. And so it just wasn't a really good working environment. And so I wanted to bring Martin on because I wanted to talk a little bit about collaborating. And made me
realize,
not
going to write with you.
Not after that,
mate. I'm not wearing a dress for anybody.
I will just slide in here and say that whenever someone says that they want constructive criticism when it comes to writing and collaborating, that means don't criticize me ever. Okay? There is no such thing in most people's mind about called constructive criticism. It just doesn't work.
Well,
as you found out.
As I found out. But I want to talk, let's talk a little bit about, you know, because music, you know, there's been some great collaborations, obviously. Think of all the great songwriting duos that are out there. And let's just start, Martin. You've written with a lot of different people and how do you do it? What kind of mindset do you have to have when you go in to collaborate, when you go in to start writing with somebody?
I think it's the most nervous situation I think I've ever been in, because you are starting a relationship with somebody. You have to trust them. That's the biggest thing. And usually you have to hope that that they're bringing something to the table that you don't have, you know. So maybe it was with me, I was writing the music a lot of times, and I would be working with a singer or a person who sang the melodies or wrote the lyrics. But it's never really easy. You have to break that. Usually the first 2 hours are a time when you're both working out how you're going to work together. It's a real relationship thing, you know. Luckily in my situation, I was put with artists that had already had been writing, you know, for a while, or were recording artists. But I used to always, before I meet with somebody, I would always prepare a lot of ideas, so that before I sat down with somebody, I would have maybe 3 or 4 pieces already in my head worked out. Because I think the most nerve-wracking thing in the world is that you sit there and nothing happens, you know, or you don't get on. And I think you've got to have a real, shall we say, open mind to just being human, you know, and being friends with the people you're working with. I mean, at least you have to start off in that place where it's not too technical. For me, it had to feel good. The room had to feel good. And you had to break the ice. And anything that was too technical or too business-like never seemed to work.
Now, let me ask you, when you start with somebody, then do you spend the first 45 minutes maybe just talking?
Sure,
or do you,
big
you
time.
Know, just what do you like? What are your influences?
Sometimes when I worked with Josh Groban, we got together for like 3 hours and just hung out. I mean, we just talked about what we loved, what we wanted to do, what he was hoping to achieve. And we got to know each other. Show them the studio. Make the room good where you're going to work, you know. And I think you've got to be prepared. It's very rare that you put two people in a room and they just jam and it happens. For me, I felt like I had to succeed if I was going to write with somebody. So I'd have lots of ideas. And if one, for instance, if I went with Earth, Wind & Fire, Maurice White, I remember, you know, playing something and he wasn't too lit up with it. And then I'd jam and say, well, I've got this other idea. And he was a bit more intrigued, and then the third idea clicked. So you've got to be prepared. For me, it was have a lot of ideas up your sleeve. But, you know, it's two human beings in a room, or right. Three human beings, or a band. So you've got to get on. So the first thing is to be human and to, you know, make the situation a good situation, an open situation to creativity. And I think the best thing you can do is you've got to trust somebody. You've got to say, hey, you know, I'm not crazy about that idea. And then let them flow and go, hey, you know, it's better than I thought. You've got to be able to move with it, flow with it, and be reasonable to other ideas. Not too locked down, you know. And then after hopefully one session, you're getting on as human beings. And you haven't got to be the best friends in the world.
Right.
But you've got to have respect for each other. That's a huge thing.
Now, is it, when you're writing with somebody, does one party or the other kind of have control, kind of guide? Or are you both kind of just you know,
putting in. I think, for instance, working with Maurice White, you know, great vocalist, great melodic ideas, a great sense of production ideas, but he wasn't a keyboard player or a chord constructor, so I would be doing the music. And if you're working with, for instance, Robbie Robertson, he's going to be looking more at the lyrics, and you realize you get to learn by being perceptive that you need to bring certain things forward. You know, with Robbie, I'd have to construct the melodies and the basic chord structure. With Maurice White, don't think too much about melodies and give him a groove. But go west, there was a guitarist and a singer. Best thing I could do would have an idea of what would be a good nature, a good groove to start on, and a good, you know, progression. So you just have to be quite perceptive on, and I think do your homework if you can. I mean, before I met with Go West or Earth, Wind and Fire, I'd studied them for about months. I knew when I got in a room with them to talk to them about what they did, what they've achieved, and you've got to do your homework. If you're going to be a songwriter and collaborate in Los Angeles with anybody, any artist, I would suggest if you get a chance from a publisher to say you're about to work with so-and-so artist, do your homework, get prepared, and think about what they would like to write. What would you imagine they'd enjoy doing?
That makes a lot of sense. In other words, kind of start, are you saying like start in a comfort zone? And then if you want to deviate, at least you're starting where you can relate to them on a musical level.
Gain their trust. Get them to respect you. They'll realize, if they're good collaborators, they'll realize your strength. And be pliable. You know, let them see that there's some things you don't do well. Keep the humor coming. Keep everything in a good space. And then they'll trust you. And before you know it, everybody's looking for, maybe 3 hours down the line, you're jamming and you're throwing things at each other that you couldn't do at first, because it's a nerve-wracking experience. And I mean, what you just said, Mike, about your collaboration, you see it all the time. Yeah. Because people are forced together and they're not on it's hard to break down the barriers. So my best way was to be prepared and to be friendly and to be optimistic about that we were going to get something, but not to force the issue. That's another big thing. I think when you force it, we need to get something done within 2 hours. We need a hit. You know, it's
right.
Doesn't work.
No, you've got to be humans first. You know,
Rob, what about some of your experiences? I know you've collaborated with a lot.
I've collaborated a lot. One of the things I want to mention that Martin pointed to that I think is one of the most important things is in the best partnerships and the best collaborations, it's when the people don't really overlap in their skill set or what their skill set is for that particular project. So like you were saying, if you're working with an artist who's great at lyrics, then you give them the foundation to come up with those lyrics. A bad partnership is if you have two lyricists and no one's strong doing a track. I've had at Noisy Neighbors Productions, we've been at it, we just passed 18 years.
Wow.
And I've been collaborating with Gary Adante that whole time, and we've written, I think over 500 projects of music together for all kinds of things, whether it's trailers, commercials, albums. We've worked with a lot of different artists. The key to our partnership, which has been a very successful partnership, is we just don't overlap much naturally. You know, he comes from a background, he's been Stevie Wonder's co-producer for many years, and he engineered and makes songs in the Key of Life, so he has that strong background as an engineer-producer. And my background was as a classical pianist originally and purely as a musician. And so initially we had zero overlap. As time's gone on, he's become more of a musician, I've become more of an engineer, and you learn from the other person.
Right.
But we've had lots of people watch us work and kind of marvel almost at what an absolutely perfect partnership we have. And I've always attributed it to the fact that we just don't overlap much. Now, we've worked with a lot of people besides each other, too. And I think I've learned what Martin was describing. You said it better than I probably would have been able to think of a way to describe it. But you really have to figure out how to complement the other person. Not, I don't mean to tell them they look nice. I mean to, like, complete.
That always helps.
That helps, too. But you want to complete where they need completing.
Right.
So
you complete.
And
me.
Also
you
to complete back off, even if you are strong at something they do, to realize that that is actually their one big strength in what they're bringing.
They're
and just
come up
don't
with something
get involved
different.
With it.
Exactly.
You know, lay off the lyrics when you're working with this person and lay off the melodies when you're working with a different person. And
it really is a relationship, even if I mean, hopefully you're not in a situation where you're just going to be put together with someone for one day with an expectation of a product coming out.
Right.
Hopefully you can actually build the relationship. excuse me. But we've been thrust into some situations where it was like a forced collaboration. I won't use any names or even describe the project too clearly, but we were put into one project, pretty high level stuff, but we were basically told to sort of be the ringmasters to create some music where the potential singers for this project were going to be brought in and they were expected to kind of write their own melody and lyrics. And we were kind of put in this situation with a bunch of very good singers, but being a good singer doesn't mean you're a good writer, of course. They're totally different skills. We were put into this situation where we were tasked with coming out with some great music written by singers who didn't even know each other and who somehow were supposed to magically collaborate. And there was a lot of money and stuff riding on this project. And it was a nightmare. I mean, we spent months trying to come up with something. And then after a while, we just said, you know what? If we don't pare this down and try to do some good, smaller collaboration,
right,
we're not going to have a product. But they actually thought if you take four or five great singers and put them in a room together, of course a great song is going to come out. And we knew that wasn't the case, but that was what we were.
And sometimes all the preparation, you know, sometimes it just doesn't come together. You know, you listen back to the end of the day's work and you go, you know, it's just not quite, there's not enough creativity in the room or
right.
Something just didn't happen. So, you know, it's not a foolproof plan, what we're saying. But
it's not. And yeah, a lot of it comes down to, if it's not working, the hardest thing in the world to do is to relax. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, that's the only thing that'll save it, mm-hmm. is if you relax and let your mind wander and try something else. Because
it's an amazing thing, as Rob was pointing out there. I've actually been in a situation where you're collaborating and the first hour it's a little tense, but everybody's trying to get to know each other. Then all of a sudden, everybody's getting on. All
yep.
of a sudden, there's a breakthrough, and you can just feel the air move. You
yep.
can just feel like we're rolling, the train's going, and we're all respecting each other, and we've got past that edginess of being in a new room, different human beings, you know.
So if you...
Luckily for me, I could always make a cup of tea and get out of the room and say, sorry, I don't know what you're talking about, I'm going to have a cup of tea.
Right.
And then come. And by the time you come back with that cup of tea, you might have calmed down enough to communicate clearly. And, you know, it's a lot to do with being a human being in a room with other people.
So if it goes bad at the very beginning, give it a little bit of time to see if it can...
I mean, sometimes it never turns, and sometimes you go, something's not going to happen here, or and it can be you. I used to be aware that if I wasn't prepared, that I didn't have a lot of ideas,
right,
that the day would be horrible.
That is
horrible.
Really important. You've talked on other podcasts, too, about how important it is to be prepared and to be thinking about the stuff, not just at the moment you're doing it.
Yeah.
And that is,
in fact, if I knew
key.
I was going to do a collaboration, I would make sure that I had 3 weeks before I met with them,
mm-hmm.
so that I'd have enough time to build ideas up in little bits. You know, I'd have, have 2 minutes of a track and an element of a chorus, and I'd put it onto DAP. And if we were all getting on, I'd say, if you didn't get off on that, I've got this really idea that I think might work. And I just play different ideas. So I'd need 3 weeks before I met with anybody. I didn't feel like I could just turn it on. Sometimes you do after you get to know them,
right.
And then you're more brave.
But you know what? It's like you said before, it's a respect thing. If you're going to be collaborating with someone, if you don't respect them and they don't respect you, you're not going to get a good result. Part of respecting someone is learning who they are and where they come from, and musically, and what they like to do and what they've done in the past.
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time, we were doing a lot of remixes. Especially for the Japanese market. And our remixes over here, no one would have heard of any of these songs. Over there, there were tons of websites dedicated to our stuff, and it was all like, they would get so excited. Noisy Neighbors is doing another remix.
Hey, were you drawn in anime?
Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Couldn't tell you that.
That'd be awesome. Robin but, anime.
So for sake of conversation, let's say yes, I absolutely was. But we would have people write to us, and we would have artists contact us to do their remixes, and they would reference other remixes we had done as if they had really paid attention and really understood what we were going for, because a lot of times these remixes were completely different than the song. We would use one line of the lead vocal and then do a completely different record because that's what the style was
right.
at the time. But we would have people who would want us to work with them who had done their homework about us, and that always felt great, and it motivated us to want to really please them, because it was obvious they like what we had done enough in the past so we can get past that barrier.
Right.
You know, when two people who are completely unfamiliar are thrust into a room and expected to be creative,
right,
that's hard. I mean, you wouldn't throw two people in a room and expect them to get along in any kind of way.
Let me ask you, Andrew, because I know you've engineered sessions where you've had people come together and kind of write songs and kind of create some stuff. Do you have any, you don't have to name names, but have you ever seen any sessions go bad? And do you have any pointers because you've seen it?
No, I mean, to be honest, I don't know that how many like writing sessions I've worked on as an engineer, but as a producer, you end up doing a lot of work to the songs. And sometimes at a point where the artist is convinced that they're already finished, and it can actually be really touching. So pre-production for me, it's always about the song structure, and it's about, oh, that melody's not so great. And it's exactly the same sort of collaboration, and it comes out of a mutual respect where, because basically all you're going to mention about their songs is the stuff you don't like. So first of all, you have to establish the fact that you love everything except what you're about to mention.
Right.
So you keep their good psyche going.
Right.
And try and get a band to be willing to work on a song, or a songwriter willing to actually change something that they feel is finished. And that is, it's almost the exact same dynamic as the writing dynamic from scratch. I mean, to come in and say, hey, have you really thought about losing that pre-chorus and turning it into the intro and making that chorus come before the bridge and then having the outro in a different key? What do you think? You know? And they think you're coming in like to just find out what tempo they're playing.
Right.
And stuff. So it carries all the way through the process of making records, that collaboration. And it'll happen in the mix. You know, sometimes you'll discover something about an arrangement that'll really drastically affect the song, and it's whatever will bring the song out, like we've talked about a million times.
Right.
But it's not songwriting, but it's this exact same dynamic with the songwriter to try and keep a positive thing going while still being able to change and adapt and get the respect from them so that they'll actually take it without getting upset, which it sounds like where what you had with your collaboration is, instead of it being, hey, I really like what you did except this about it, it was, yeah, I hate what you just did.
I think what we're saying, there's a big psychological thing.
Huge. It's 90%.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask Scott, actually, because one of the things – good morning, Scott. Hello. I mean, the nature of what you do as a film sound supervisor, you're constantly dealing with large teams because you're working on huge projects where you have to have everybody basically collaborate – and get along, because it's, I mean, anybody who knows anything about doing sound for a film, it's not a one-man job. It takes a lot of people. But you have a lot of different egos and personalities and specialties, but they do have to work together. How do you force a collaboration like that and have it still be artistic and creative?
Yeah, I do agree with everything that's been said so far in the fact that you do have to be prepared. You have to have your ideas. You also have to know the styles. A lot of times what I'll do is I have to take a lot of different types of audio. I've got to take actors' performances. I've got to take composer's music. I've got to take a director's ideas and thoughts and try to make it make sense out of all of them. And sometimes they're all on different tracks. And sometimes a composer will do large music over dialogue. And it's trying to be a multimedia, and the fact that sometimes it's not about the music, it's not about the actors, it's about a feeling. And trying to put those together, usually the director has the last say in the film process. But at the same point, he wants input. And you've got to throw different ideas down. A lot of times he'll ask for one thing, and I may not believe in it. So what I'll do is I'll do what he's asking, and I'll do something different.
Is that what the teams end up doing a lot? Like if you have three guys working on, you know, sound effects for a big action scene or whatever, they have to cooperate somehow, right? I mean, they're not in a vacuum.
Usually the director will ask me, kind of give me some input or not input. A lot of times they'll say, look, I don't know what I want, but I need something. I just want to be excited in this area, and here I want to be very intimate. Then I'll take my taste, but then I'll work with my teams, and I'll meet with the composer. We'll talk about what he's thinking. And we'll try to figure out how to best strategically go after the sounds we're looking for. But then, as in any process, while it's necessary not writing music, when you're doing the mix, it's almost like a song because you're saying, you know what? let's drop the music here. Or let's drop the dialogue because they're not really saying anything, but the music's going to carry the emotion of the scene. So there's so many variations that you can go with that.
But does the mix end up being easier if your teams have worked closer together
leading
up to that point?
It is. It's the same thing. Trust is a huge part. Because if there's one person in the room that's not trusted, it's awkward. So what happens is somebody in the room may say, hey, I have an idea. Let's try this for a second. You go down that path. And then you have to trust enough that even if it sounds like it's a bad idea, you'll know that when you actually hear the idea, if it's bad, people go, wow, that actually sucks.
We tried it.
But it's not a good idea. So,
You know what? That actually brings back a point that I think I talked about on a previous podcast. But one of the biggest mistakes that people make when they're starting out to write a song or whatever is prematurely thinking they're done. And if you've written a song, you have verse, chorus, B section, whatever, and you think it's good, but you're not sure if it's as good as it needs to be, there is no harm in just setting it aside and trying for a different chorus or trying for a different verse. You know, people get married to their own ideas oftentimes way too easy, and it leads to mediocre product. If you have a great verse and a great chorus, but you think your B section is a little weak, try to come up with another B section. You can always go back to the way it was. You know, especially in this day and age, you can record everything as a master. It all will sound great. You can always go back to your idea, but it's a huge mistake not to be willing to try something else. And that's something when I start to collaborate with someone recently, I've been writing with more young songwriters who I've never worked with before, and we're building these new relationships. One of the things they learn about me right away is even if we're on an idea that we think is amazing, I will always say, you know what? We've got it. Let's try something else. If we don't come up with something stronger, we know we love what we got.
Right.
There's no harm in that. A lot of times, if you say, I'm going to try to come up with something better, you end up writing a whole second song because you go down some different path. Your brain is thinking differently. And then you end up with two songs that are underway. But you should never be afraid to experiment, especially with how easy the technology makes it today to record everything.
Now, I have a question because I see that a lot of times you got sound design films, but there's also what I consider music design, which is, you know, you've got your melody, somebody can sing it, you've got a rhythm. But then all of a sudden, the instruments, or what I call ear candy, becomes a very big part, whether it's an interesting bass line or whether it's some weird vocal in the background that just your ears go to and it sounds exotic and it's catchy. There's that pop tune now, or you're the guy that does kind of that Rastafari Jamaican kind of thing in the background. Anyway, there's a lot of different types of
new Richard Marx single.
Yeah. At what point, because you've already written the song, you kind of know the structure, it's okay. It's not like, you know, you're going to pick up your guitar and play it, because a lot of pop music's much more rhythmical than that. But everything from picking the instruments, which a lot of times becomes the song.
Well, that's the producer's job. And a lot of times the writers are the producers these days, just because it's easy to be your own producer. It's not easy to be a good producer, but it's easy to produce your own stuff because you can do it on a laptop computer as opposed to a big expensive studio. But the producer, if the song idea is solid, then a great producer will make it an interesting sounding record, and a lame producer will make it a boring sounding record.
Well, Martin, you're a master at doing that, where you add all those little snippets,
ear candy.
But that's not writing, right, Martin? I mean, would you say that part is?
You know, it's a mixture of everything. I don't tend to think of the ear candy first. I never have. And the production to me has always been the second thing. You know, the mood, the feel, the song. You know, I'm vintage in that feeling. You know, I think it's a great example. Just listening to the Beatles, you know, they came in with two acoustic guitars, and George Martin listened to what that it was a good song, and then they decided how to make it shine. You know, to show it in its best light. And I think production is to show something in its best light. The problem is sometimes the word commercial does not mean that it's seen in its best light, in my point of view. But I think it's really great when you get a good song and then you get production which really complements it, can make it commercial. And I think we saw it a lot, you know, with people like Trevor Horn and George Martin. They would, they'd find a good song and then you would, but you'd also be pulled a great deal towards like listening to the Anvil Sound on Maxwell's Silver Hammer, or we'd listen to Relax, Don't Do It by Frankie Goes to Hollywood and right. go, what a bass sound, what a track. So to me, production is just really, really important on what the nature of the song is.
Well, let me ask you really quick. This is going to deviate a little bit about from collaborating, but as long as we're speaking of production, let me take your song, The Long Walk Home. When you were writing that song has a great build. It starts off really, really just simple, and it has a great build. Were you thinking of the build as you were writing, or did the build kind of happen after you were done?
Well, you chose a really, really good song to ask me about because I'd finished that song with everything in it, didn't know what the production was. It was much faster, and I had lots of guitars in it, and it was recorded a certain way, and I had the chance to do what Rob said. I stood back and went, this is how I imagined it being, but it's not working. And then I went through a depression. And as I was going through the depression, I knew how the song should be, and I absolutely stripped it bare and mixed it for about a whole day with hardly anything in it until it spoke to me in a depressive, dark space. And so from the first versions of that song, and in fact, when I played it to people in the new version that made it on the album, they were like, what have you done? You know? And over time, it lasted because people could see the way I was going. But here's a really great example of finishing the song and then having time to go, as Bobby would say, f***ing wrong, you know?
I would.
Well, it was like that. But this is what happened to that song. And more than any other song on the new album, it was that way, where it was stripped bare. And, you know, the song had guitars going from beginning to end. The rhythm was going. And I decided that the rhythm shouldn't come until halfway through. But what this means is that if you're writing a good song, you need to be depressed.
Well, the easiest way to be depressed is write a bad song. So.
Well, it's a great song. And if I'm not trying to give you a shameless plug, but if you want to know what we're talking about, it's on Martin's new album, In the Temple of the Muse. And it really is. It's a great song. It has a great push. It's really a good song.
You know what? I also want to say, it's going back a while, but some of my favorite examples of like production that fit a song perfectly. And if you listen now, it reminds you back to that era. I guess by today's standards, it's dated, but I still love it. But
Richard Marx.
No, the Go West stuff. Those Go West records were incredibly well produced. And I remember back when those were out, those were the records we listened to for sonic inspiration. Like, that's what a mix should sound like. That's what mastering should sound like.
This brings us to a good point about collaboration, because the first two albums and Dancing on the Couch and the very first one with We Close Our Eyes, I was such a fan of them.
Because
it was Arif Mardin, you know, doing English pop soul music. And before I met with him to collaborate with him, I knew everything about those albums. Mm-hmm. And I was able to talk to him about it and say, I'm a fan, and I get this, and I get that. So, you know, here again is what you were just saying. I'm studying ahead of time. If you're going to work with somebody that has done something, it's really good to be actually like their stuff as well, which I did.
Yeah, you're lucky if you're working with someone who's actually done great stuff. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And in fact, Mike, sorry for jumping in, but for people that aren't going to work with people that have had recording contracts or are well known, and you're just going to work with another person who's a writer, it's good to find out what they love, the kind of music they like, if they play guitar, if you prefer to do singing, or you're a good lyricist, and that's why the 2 hours together before, even in a coffee shop, is good to just vibe.
Find the common ground.
Knowing their influences is huge, because sometimes I've been working with bands and I'll get demos, and from the way they've produced their demos, you think, oh wow, they really kind of want to be like this, but it's weird with the music. And then you finally talk to them and you say, so it sounds like you guys really like this band. Like, oh God, no. No, is it coming? And they don't even think that it's coming across that way. And they start naming their influences and how they're writing and how they want it to be. And you hear their songs in a totally different light, and you see what direction they can go. And it's big.
We're working with a band right now that's kind of like that, where to hear their early demos, you would think they're one kind of band, and then you ask them who they want to be, and it's just completely different. And the truth is, they musically, they write the kind of stuff that could lead them to where they want to be. It's just they've never known how to capture it. You know, just because you hear it in your head doesn't mean you can create it out of some speakers. There's a lot of skill that goes into that that people don't realize.
Well, to wrap this up, I think after talking to all you guys, I kind of know where things went south with my whole collaboration. And I think the first thing was, I think expectations were a little high on my end. The second thing was, I didn't have patience. And the third thing is she just lied.
Fair enough.
In what way?
Well, if you're going to collaborate and you're going to come, you know, if you say that you know, you're really great with melodies and you really can do a lot of things with melodies, then be great with melodies. If you're not strong, I mean, it'll, you know what? All your weak links are going to show up when you actually get there and you start writing. So, you know, it's you know, you're not going to be able to hide behind anything.
You know what? I would say it is a huge mistake to ever make any kind of judgment about somebody's creative talent and abilities and experience and everything else from their description of themselves. I have had so many meetings with so many people where I can't even go into all these. I can't go into these stories. Let me just say, I've dealt with many singers and many artists who saw their future in the industry as one thing and had 2 or 3 hour conversations about who they liked, who they didn't like, why they thought they were better than this person, right, or not as good as this person. Right. And then when you actually hear what they're capable of, it's a whole different story.
Yeah.
You have to go based on what you hear, not what they describe.
And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know,
you hear musically,
anything I do is fantastic or anything, but at least I know my strengths and I know my weaknesses, and I've had a great experience, you know, just jamming with, you know what, actually, Martin, when I did that little song and you came in, I it was really, for me, it was just a privilege to spend an evening one time with Martin, and he was helping me out with a song, and I played him the little riff that I got, and Martin gets on the mic and he scats a melody that was just dead on, and it was like, you know, it was great, you know, to, because you have such a great sense of melody, it was great to work in that environment. Yeah. And so I guess, you know, having that kind of experience, you expect certain things, and I just think it's, you know, you guys have said a lot of really good things.
You're not gonna have the same experience with some singer you found in the recycler.
No, I know. I'm not.
He might.
No,
he might.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying.
Craigslist, he will. Actually,
I'd be a little bit stronger. Actually.
I am just saying that, you know.
Bobby agrees anyway.
It's just from what, you know, it's one thing to talk the talk. It's another thing to walk the walk, you know, and just from what was coming across and the influences and all that. And like I said, I could have been a little more patient, but
also you can tell sometimes, when you're talking about having patience, it's because these people have a track record.
Right, right.
And you know that it should be able to work, but maybe you're incompatible. It's also possible to know within 5 minutes that you're completely wasting your time,
right,
and that's fair enough.
And I think that's what kind of seeped in, because I knew right off the bat, it's like, nope, you know, but you're there and you spend the time to get together and to come down to the studio and to get the mics all set up, and so you want to kind of see.
It's kind of like dating, you know? You just got to say, hey, we have a little common. Let's do it again.
Yeah, but diva meets impatient songwriter.
That just
sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, that was Mentos and Diet Coke.
Yeah. She was Mentos, you were Diet Coke.
That's what it was, but... we'll try again. Maybe I got to go to Craigslist, like you said.
Oh, man.
Get away from the recycler. But I really wanted to do it because, you know, we have the privilege of being in the area where you have a lot of musicians. You have a lot of really great musicians, you know, in Southern California. But there's people out there that are going to be writing with people that they only find on the internet, or they only find on the.
But it still has to be from a point of mutual respect,
right,
when you actually
exactly
sit down to work,
and hopefully a little bit enjoyable. You know, you sit with some people and it can be enjoyable. You can
yeah,
you can
be.
You can fail and go.
Except
for
what about those relationships where you're like at each other? and then you go, ooh, that's really good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, that's another good point, actually, because you can look at Pete Townsend, and, you know, if he's writing with Daughtry sometimes, it can be edgy.
Oh, the contentious thing
comes,
is good.
Yeah,
but they were held together by the fact that they were still in the band. This wasn't just two random people being edgy and then coming up with something.
Which goes back to respect.
Hey, Jagger and, Stones, you got to think about that.
I hate you, but I respect you.
Yeah. Well, it's like family at that point. If you're in a band and you've been in a band for a while, you can fight like, you know, whatever, but you're still in that family. You're still in the band.
Well, all I know is it's definitely an adventure, and it's not easy. And the songwriters that get out there and find their partner.
Got to say though, sometimes collaboration will be great because you'll actually come up with something that you never could. You know,
right.
Sometimes it's great to write with somebody else who has a strength because you go, I would have never written that, and this other person has brought so much to the party here. So you know, it's also good to think to people that say I don't want to collaborate. It's like you should try it because sometimes you do really better than you ever could have dreamt. You know.
What about the collaborations where they may not be adding as much, but they help you focus? They bring something out within that artist that they could not bring out by themselves.
There's a lot of that. Intangible stuff is often most important.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The vibe. The vibe is a psychological
thing. It's like, I would do this, but then you took me here, which made me think of that, and now all of a sudden I'm in a better direction.
You know, in fact, with Go West, with King of Wishful Thinking, I had the groove. And I had the melody and an idea of where it should go. The lead singer had some of the lyrics, and the guitarist had the title. And that's how that song was written. Mm-hmm. And then they'd leave me to do the music. The singer would come in, sing it, and then the guitarist would come in and have an overview. So we all had our little gigs to do, and that's how it worked. And we didn't push it any more than that. We knew our strengths, and then it's good fun.
Hey, what was the snare sound on King of Wishful Thinking? Do you remember? Because I'd love that.
No, I didn't produce the track.
Oh, okay.
Peter Wolf produced the
track. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so we did the demo. And then
he did?
Peter Wolf did the track.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Peter Wolf was actually the guy who, you know, took my song These Dreams to heart. He was a keyboard player.
Yeah,
and then
I
he went
Peter.
On to do Starship, and then went on to do Go West. So
that's a great snare sound on that.
Yeah, I can't say that I know that one, Mike. Sorry.
But it's a great song, too.
I really apologize about that.
Well, we just have to get Peter on the podcast.
I mean, Bobby uses lots of different snares, doesn't
he?
All right, well, hey, we're going to wrap it up. But thanks a lot, Martin, for joining us. And
my privilege, my always great fun.
And now I know what I did wrong, and I'll try to do better next time. Vanessa.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now you can blurb the show
right now.
And you don't you don't have to, you know, listen to it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And you know, Vanessa's a brilliant collaborator because she works with us with our website.
Oh,
she is. She has to be creative all the time. We all have to, but then we have to blend though. I mean, it's you know, we have to, as Rob was saying and Andrew, collaboration is right through the industry. You know, it's every aspect of it.
No, definitely, and she. Definitely writes way better than I do. So the blurbs are usually way better than what I write on the website. And she also says, you know, there's a spelling error.
Oh,
right there.
Yeah.
So I have to go back
on. Okay, there are, sorry.
So it's good to have her as a safety net. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Rob, are you doing anything you talk about? Or almost next podcast?
Yeah, I've been saying that for a long time.
You can actually talk about what you were doing, by the way.
Oh, I can?
You can.
The most recent one or the one before?
The one you were doing with us.
The most recent one or the one before?
Both.
The three?
Yes.
This is getting very exciting.
I know.
Yes.
What is this?
Wait, drum roll. Because he was like, I said, can you say what this?
So I am actually loud?
You are loud.
All right. I'll tell you next time. No. No, for months and months.
And months.
And months.
Months.
We were working.
Sticky audio. No.
No, I'm just going to say, we were working on the video games that are going to be based on High School Musical 3, the billion-dollar Disney franchise, and we were working on the interactive games that are going to accompany that theatrical film. I don't remember when the film is coming out, but it's not in too long.
Oh, I don't think we're supposed to say that. Sorry.
No, no, we did this with Soundlux DMG. And that's Scott apparently got the word. We're not allowed to talk about it, so it must mean its release is imminent. But it was an interesting project because we knew it was going to be really, really high profile. And we've done other interactive titles for Disney, but this one seemed to have an extra layer of just push behind it. Well, secrecy everything, because it's such a massive
franchise
for them. So
congratulations.
Thank you. And it, I also have to give a shout out to Greg Pagani, who helped us with a lot of the vocals for this. This was by far the most intricate vocal production we've ever had to do on a project.
Wow.
By far.
Well, once the game comes out.
You can almost hear the bags under my eyes from this one.
Once the game comes out, we should, we'll talk about it more, because I'm sure there's be some.
You're trying to get me to miss my first podcast, man? Is that what
you're Nothing.
No, but it'd be great. It'd be great to dissect it and, you know, just let us know.
Yeah, it was actually a really, really sophisticated project, and because of how complex it was and how we had different things going on in different studios, we ended up using the internet in a lot of unbelievable ways. There was a bunch of tracks came in from Nashville. There was a whole bunch of stuff that was really complicated to coordinate, but in the pre-internet era, this project couldn't have even happened.
Wow. Well,
so we'll have stuff to talk about.
You'll have to talk about that. Andrew, I do know that you know, the Metallica is coming out actually before the next one.
Decompressing from that, but that's out, in a couple weeks.
Yeah, so 2 weeks. Actually.
Yeah, September 12th. So, 12th. No, but I've been working on college applications with my son, which makes me feel very old, but it's it's pretty cool.
You know what's interesting? I'll point out that between Andrew's Metallica work and my High School Musical 3 work, we do not share a single audience member.
But cover probably 80% of the country.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, the next podcast after this one, actually we're going to be talking to Andrew a little bit more in depth about the mixing. It's actually, we're going to be doing a podcast on mixing, and so I'd like to discuss it a little bit more on your challenges and things like that. Because, you know, we're going to dive into mixing.
But
and,
the cool thing is, as part of doing these applications, is we're actually recording one of Jake's songs, my son's songs. He wrote a song, and now we're tracking it so it can go in as part of his application, which should be very fun, because it's really
bizarre. Where's he applying to?
Hmm?
Where's he applying?
His first choice is Yale, actually.
Wow.
So that's...
Wow.
Yeah.
What's your son's name?
Jake.
And what does he want to study?
He has no idea.
But Yale's a great place to go.
Exactly. When you have no idea,
but I want to go to Yale.
Andrew is looking for projects to mix.
No, we don't have to go into their financial aid. It's actually pretty good, so it's all right.
Scott, we know you were mixing locally.
Yes. And then I'm going back to a project which I could talk about in a year, believe it or not.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. How's that for a bad teaser?
Is that High School Musical 4?
Will the podcast still be going?
Why don't we just do this? I'm just 12 times in a row, I'm going to ask you what you're going to be doing, and you can just say, I can't talk about it. And then, I mean, even if you're not at the show, I'll just cut you in.
But no, I actually finish it up in about 2 weeks.
Wow.
And then we have to be done by the end of October, and then it releases in the summer. But it'll be one of the 2009 big blockbusters.
Wow.
So
that's cool.
Yeah, it's supposed to release in the winter, and the security on this show is the highest I've ever seen.
Wow.
So, I mean, it doesn't exist.
How do they let you out?
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, we've got it to the point where if somebody walks in the room, we have to take the video down.
Wow.
They can't even see anything visually what we're working on.
Wow.
It makes Godzilla look like something small.
Yeah, because Godzilla was pretty crazy security.
Yeah. I mean, it's highly anticipated.
Wow.
But the security is pretty wild.
So Yentl 2.
American Pie 8.
You know, the studios, though, they're really paranoid about that kind of stuff. I mean, when I did Lord of the Rings, I mixed all the TV commercials for the film. It was, you know, we had to black out the window. They had to dead patch everything. Had to have a direct connection between the monitor and the tape machine. And I totally understand.
The studio made us put self-closing doors and self-locking locks.
Wow.
And then there's timers on our computers that if we walk away for too long, it locks people out, and then you got to log back in. It's a whole...
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's pretty crazy, yeah.
You step away for a half hour, and it formats your hard drive.
Yeah, really.
Over where I mix during the day, they put in... We did a high-profile project, and it was in our audio tour room, and they put in a camera that shot on the screen of where the mixer was. So there was just a camera that's on the wall, and the only thing you see is the mixer and his screen. You know, monitoring him every time he works on the project. That's crazy.
I mean, they gave us scenes rather than reels, and they're not in any order, and they're all named like gibberish. So if you'd ever see it, you'd have no clue what you're looking at.
Wow.
So even you're not sure if
we're... Well, you know, it's funny. I've never seen the show because it's...
Yeah.
You go, okay, that scene, is it before this scene or that scene?
No, I can imagine.
And it is.
They know that you could pass on some information. You know?
They prefer not to. And just recently, they started putting real numbers to it. But, you know, usually most shows are like 5-6 reels and... Now we're up to 11 or 12.
If we don't see you for a few weeks, we're going to be very nervous. Very nervous.
I'll walk outside. There's a guy waiting. Thank you. Get in the car now.
You've already said too much.
Wait. All I want to know is, does the animal sound like a duck in this scene and like a camel in that scene?
Actually, speaking about llamas. No, I'm actually going on a journey for the next month. And I'm going to be traveling all over the United States recording exotic animals. It's kind of a new thing. So in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have to go to Florida to record crocodiles.
Wow.
So I get to go into a crocodile pit, and then we're doing lions, and we're just going to be going all over the place recording
animals.
I will
still be scared if I don't see you.
Yeah, really well.
I'm
more scared.
I didn't even know they formed a band, so that's good.
<You're awesome.
laughs> And Vanessa, we started with you, and once again...
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And, keeping up with the podcast. And,
yeah.
And Pagey Boy?
Yeah, that's
my
You're
still
name.
Working on your
yeah,
next
I am.
One?
Yeah, I'm very, very near to finishing the next record, which is a pleasure. I'm pushing along and feeling rather creative. And, it's all going very, very well. And it's a lovely joy to see Vanessa because she works on the East Coast for us all year.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to bump into her over here.
That is great.
So everything's good. What about you, Bobby?
Not much.
He hasn't talked this much. I think he's a little upset.
He's very under the weather. Yeah. Something.
All right. Well, hey, if you have any questions or comments for us, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Or you can reach us on our MySpace page, which Vanessa will read each and every post that gets there. It's myspace.com/audionowcast. And that's about it. Thanks for listening. Have a good one, and we'll see you next time.
Listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.